My guest Richard Ford's new novel, The Lay of the Land, is his third book about his character Frank Bascom. Frank is a sports writer turned New Jersey real estate agent who first appeared in Ford's 1986 novel, The Sports Writer, and returned in the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel, Independence Day. By the time the new novel has started, Frank's 9-year-old son has died, his first marriage has collapsed, and his second wife has left him for her first husband. The new novel is set in 2000 in the days just before Thanksgiving, as Frank is preparing to host a family reunion. He's gotten treatment for prostate cancer, and his 25-year-old daughter has been helping him through it. Frank is 55 and living through the period of life that he describes as the permanent period, a period in which you should quit worrying about your own existence and get busy doing and being. Here's a short reading.
One of the pure benefits of the permanent period, when you're as nose down and invisible to yourself as an actualized, unchangeable non-becomer, as snugged into life as a planning board member, is that you realize you can't completely screw everything up anymore, since so much of your life is on the books already. You've survived it. Cancer itself doesn't really make you fear the future and what might happen. It actually makes you, at least it's made me, not as worried as you were before you had it. It might make you concerned about lousing up an individual day or wasting an afternoon like this one, but not your whole life.
That's Richard Ford reading from his new novel, The Lay of the Land. Richard Ford, how did you come up with this idea of the permanent period of someone's life?
Well, I was trying to make the novel, my novel, useful to its readers to identify periods of life which might otherwise be overlooked, sort of periods when you're sort of in the middle of things and can't see one end and can't see the other end. And something needs to be done about those periods to make them seem singular, to make them seem that you're living in an epoch of life which you as an individual can make good use of. So I made that up for them, just as I did in Independence Day for the existence period of life. So it's, again, something I think a novel can be useful for.
And what was the existence period of life that your character was in your previous novel about him?
I don't think I even remember.
I see it was very helpful to you.
I know you're supposed to remember all those things, but I'm not sure I remember. This novel's so full in my face these days. I'm just now getting out from under its spell on my life. But it was a period, the existence period was a period in the one's 40s when, again, you might be likely to be so nosed down and snugged into whatever you're doing that you don't notice what's around you. And for Frank, anyway, in Independence Day, it was not a particularly halcyon period of his life. And I was just trying to identify it for him, for Frank, and thereafter for readers, so that they could say, well, this period is not just a period to exist in, it's a period to live in.
The Lay of the Land is in part about mortality, and you've given your main character prostate cancer.
Yes.
In deciding what affliction you were going to give him, why did you give him prostate cancer?
I probably gave him prostate cancer because it's one of those ones that terrifies me. Every year, you know, you go in for your PSA exam, and my heart skips about 8,000 beats every time I do that. My mother died of metastatic breast cancer, and one of my relatives on the day of her funeral was kind enough to tell me that I was probably going to get prostate cancer because she had, I guess it's my cousin's way of helping me grieve, that I was probably going to get prostate cancer because my mother had that. And so that always completely nerved me up every time I went in to get my blood studies at the Mayo Clinic. And so it just seemed, you know, just the most natural thing to do. Well, why not give him that, since it's the thing that freaks me out so much? And then I also afterwards did a lot of research about it and found that it had all kinds of language associated with it, which I was happy to put in play in a book. I mean, a lot of things that go into novels because the writer gets access to language which she or he wants to put in play in a book and see if that language can be made interesting in a new context.
To write this book, you had to think a lot about mortality. And is that a subject you're preoccupied with when you're not writing?
Well, it must be true. I hate for it to be true, since there's so many more interesting things to think about than that. But it probably is true. I was to bring in lumbering old biography, I was the kid of older parents and the grandchild of much older grandparents. And my family members started kicking off at about age 4 or 5 and went right along kicking off till that whole pair of generations was gone, basically. So I think I grew up in Mississippi and Arkansas with a very vivid sense of people passing on. And when I was 20 and I had just joined the Marine Corps, I got hepatitis, and I had never been sick before, and I was in the hospital for a long time. And one day the doctor came in my room and he said to me, "Well, Richard," he said, "I don't think you're going to die now." And I thought, die? When did die get to be in this conversation? And thereafter, I became very hyper aware of my health and all of those kinds of matters that have to do with mortality. And so there we are, bing, bang, bong, 40 years later, I'm writing novels about it.
So when you were young and your older relatives were dying, what were the first things that you were told about death and what happens to somebody you know and love when they die?
Well, we were talking about the 1940s now, and both of my parents, who were wonderful parents, I should say, were not educated people. So we didn't have an ongoing death and grieving seminar in my life. People said, "Oh, Aunt Lizzie, she died." And that was kind of it. And then we got in the car and drove up to Northwest Arkansas, and there indeed was Aunt Lizzie dead. And that was pretty much the end of the seminar. And we weren't much churchy people, so that there wasn't a lot of talk about the afterlife or where people went. It was pretty much presented as a fact that happened, and we could all get kind of used to it, which I did. That was kind of the end of it.
So, you know, we'd been talking about your new novel, which is the close, you say, of a trilogy. Are you certain that you'd never write about this character again?
Well, I'm not as certain about it as I am of some things that I'm certain about. I don't have any urge necessarily to work that hard again. It was a challenge to bring this novel to its completion. And I thought to myself during the past year when Christina and I were working on this book, I was reading it aloud to her. I thought to myself, I hope the finishment of this book allows me to do something different. And by that, I don't mean, you know, to go to medical school, but to just maybe write something different that wasn't quite as onerous as that was being at the time. And I'm not complaining, because if you are a novelist, you have no reason or right to complain, because you choose to do this. No one makes or asks you even to do it. But on the other hand, it has its stresses, and I thought that's maybe about enough for me. I also don't know, Christina said for me never to say this, but I'll say it anyway, I don't know if writing about Frank in his 60s would interest me that much. Not to say that people alive in their 60s don't live vibrant, useful lives. I just don't have any clue about what I would say about it. And I think it's some level of urging as a novelist or as a poet or as an essayist. You have to be able to think, I think I can dream up something interesting and useful about this subject, and I don't know about that if I could.
You mentioned that before you publish, you read what you've written out loud to your wife. Why not give her the printed pages? Why do you read it out loud?
Well, I mean, she does have the printed pages. She's looking at a printed page, and I'm looking at a printed page, and we're sitting across a room from each other, and I'm reading it out loud. it's really an effort to bring her intelligence to bear, which is a good intelligence, and it's also an attempt for me to authorize every squiggle, every jot, every word choice, every paragraph break. I think that that, for me, since I'm dyslexic, is about the best way that I can do that. That to read things aloud and to hear everything, although there are some liabilities inherent in reading things aloud, but from the standpoint of authorizing everything, being sure that I am responsible for every single movement in the book, that's the best way for me to do it, although it takes months to do that, you can imagine.
Is this because, like, if you just reread it, you can just kind of glide quickly over the parts that you don't really like or that need work? Just, like, pretend it didn't happen, whereas if you're reading it out loud, you have to speak every word and any of the problems become more apparent?
Well, the second part of that is certainly true. I mean, I'm too much of a Protestant ethic guy to ever glide over anything that I've written. I just really slog through it. What I do, though, I'm sorry Christina isn't here to verify this, I can read something to myself and get it quite wrong, which is to say that the words on the page are not the words that register in my brain when I read it, and I'll start revising something that doesn't need to be revised because I will have read it wrong. So that when I read something out loud, I at least have her there to say, now, look, sweetheart, it says blue lights here, but you read yellow lights. And so just as a sort of a verifier of what I have on the page and what I want to have on the page, it's very useful for me to read it out loud. It's just part, as I say, of being dyslexic. I mean, and moreover, she says, you know, that as I'm reading something, that I will just start revising it from what's on the page through my brain and out my mouth, so that as I'm reading something along, I'm revising it and saying something that's not there. And what she will say to me quite patiently is, now, you may like this new way better, and you may not even have known that you were revising it in this way, but you were, and is this the way you want it? It's always slightly distressing to have that happen, but nonetheless it happens.
Does having dyslexia interfere with the pleasure of reading and with the work of writing?
Absolutely not. And it should be said that I'm not severely dyslexic. I am mildly dyslexic. I think from the time I was a kid and slow to learn to read in the first and second grades and third grades, that I had to learn to read very slowly, much more slowly than was true for my classmates in Mississippi in the 40s, and 50s rather, and that one of the things I fell heir to were all of those, so to say, poetical aspects of language, the non-specifically cognitive aspects in which language is just a vehicle for communication, so that I became quite aware in my mouth and in my ear of language's sonorities and its syncopations and rhythms and pauses and meter and all of those things about prose, indeed. And that, in fact, that enhanced my appreciation of language and enhanced my appreciation of written literature. So that, no, it was not at all, other than to slow me down considerably, it was not at all a detriment in causing me to appreciate reading or to be inclined to write. I mean, it was me making, instinctually a virtue out of a vice, but goodness gracious, there was a virtue there.
Richard Ford, thank you very much for talking with us.
It's been a pleasure, Terry. Thank you.
Richard Ford's new novel is called The Lay of the Land.